Good afternoon and welcome to the April meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the Midcoast of Maine. And a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum. Since 1983, we're now in our 31st year, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service or academia, international businessmen or journalists, talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker, Peter Mattis. He's a fellow in the China program at the Jamestown Foundation and a PhD student in politics and international studies at Cambridge in England. He edited Jamestown's biweekly China Brief from 2011 to 2013. Prior to that, he'd worked as an international affairs analyst for the American government. He received his MA in security studies from Georgetown, his BA in political science and Asian studies from the University of Washington, and also spent a year at a Chinese university in Beijing. So we're delighted to have Peter here today. His topic is Chinese intelligence.
Well, first of all, a thank you to Jim and Mac for inviting me and having me here to speak. It's always fun to talk about this subject, which doesn't get a lot of print, and it doesn't get a lot of discussion. And so today's topic is Chinese intelligence operations, not U.S. intelligence on China. That's another topic for another time. One of the things that's interesting is that you almost every week you see a new op-ed, a new article, a new magazine column related to China's rise and its impact on the international system. And every year there's probably five or six books that deal with the contemporary China question. What does China's rise mean? How do we interpret it? How do we interact? But one of the fascinating blind spots in all of this discussion is how do China's leaders learn about the world? Most of them are not well-traveled. Most of them, like all politicians, have their professional life focused domestically. And it seems strange that as security concerns about China have risen, we've ignored this facet of China's rise and the rise of Chinese intelligence. What's even more strange is that if you read the articles that are out there on Chinese intelligence, I don't think that it would be too far of a cry to say that however factually correct those articles might be, the interpretation is almost entirely wrong. There are less than five people in the West who have ever used a Chinese source to write publicly about Chinese intelligence. And when you look at those sources, you see something a little bit different than what you may have read in the paper or heard from former FBI agents about how China collects intelligence. So with that, I'll sort of transition into the discussion, which is there's really four points that make up the misconceptions. The first is that there's no Chinese word for intelligence, that intelligence and information are the same thing. Well, for the Chinese speakers out there, there is a difference, as we know, between Xinxi and Qingbao. And they do have different sorts of connotations. And yes, Qingbao can be translated as information, but it almost always means information in motion. It's going somewhere. It's doing something. It's not just data lying around. The second is that you've probably heard the grains of sand or the mosaic approach to Chinese intelligence. And this idea is that these are amateurs, not professionals. Their focus is on science and technology. Their focus is on recruiting ethnic Chinese to do work for the motherland, and that they don't really use professional intelligence tradecraft that we saw during the Cold War, you know, the dead drops in the dark of night, you know, clandestine meetings with people, meetings in third countries, recruiting people based on money and coercion. that seems to be the prevailing view of how the Chinese intelligence problem is understood. The third point is that when we talk about American and Chinese intelligence, we're almost never talking about the same thing. When someone says US intelligence, we automatically, in our minds, start to think about CIA, NSA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the FBI. But when someone mentions Chinese intelligence, or they write about Chinese intelligence, they include a variety of organizations and people that go beyond the formal intelligence organizations. And in some cases, they're not even talking about the formal intelligence organizations that are doing the work. You know, when you say Chinese intelligence, you think often companies like Huawei get mentioned or sort of thrown into the mix. But if you mention American intelligence, we don't think of Boeing or Goldman Sachs or, you know, in the West, IHS and Jane's or Merrill Lynch or any of a host of other companies with global interests and a global effort to collect information that's valuable to them. So when we say U.S. intelligence, we mean something very, very specific. But when Chinese intelligence is mentioned, it's this broad spectrum of activity that includes ordinary citizens, in some cases not even Chinese citizens, and a range of companies and individuals and government actors. And so what this effect is that if you look at cases and you look at the way that they operate, rather than having a few very focused cases related to intelligence, we instead have literally hundreds of investigations into technology transfer or violations of intellectual property rights. So when I'm talking about Chinese intelligence, I'm bringing the focus a little more narrowly, speaking about the Ministry of State Security, speaking about the People's Liberation Army's General Staff Department and its second department, or its third department, which is responsible for signals intelligence. The fourth point is that there's a tendency to think that all Chinese government and non-government collection of information and technology is linked. That somehow, because it's a communist state with a lingering Leninist party, that it controls everything and information flows freely among all of the different organizations. And I can see some smiles from some people who know a bit better about the Chinese government and how it works. These four points have really moved our focus away from where it should be in trying to understand the Chinese intelligence challenge. It's been exoticized, it's been mysticized. And we've wanted to think that the disciples of Sun Tzu are in some ways, you know, so much more sophisticated or subtle than the way we do it in the West. But for those of you who are familiar with the British double cross operations during World War II, I invite you to look at the opening chapter on the theory and practice of intelligence by one of the practitioners in World War II. And it reads exactly the same way as Sun Tzu's chapter 13 on spies. So if these are the ways not to do it, what's the better way? Well, one of the sort of canonical figures of US intelligence, Sherman Kent, described intelligence as being simultaneously a concept, an organization, and an operation or a process. And that's going to be the way that I organize the rest of this presentation, to discuss Chinese intelligence concepts, their organizations, and how they collect. So how has it been defined? One of China's intellectual giants, a fellow named Qian Shuisun, who's the father of their rocket program, the father of their modern S&T library system, called intelligence activating knowledge or catalytic knowledge. He also described it as knowledge to resolve a specific decision-making problem. And there are several implications that follow from this that he described. First, that it must be true. Second, that it's not random. There has to be some sort of systematic approach to its collection and dissemination. And third, because the focus is on a decision-making problem, it must be timely and it must be relevant. And if it's neither of those things, then it's not intelligence. If you look at what the People's Liberation Army has published in their training materials, such as the Science of Military Intelligence, intelligence is very clearly a subset of information. It is defined by its purposefulness, its objectivity, its timeliness, And at its core, intelligence is fundamentally a process of transmission. In the US, we often talk about dissemination. And it's worth keeping in mind that disseminating means that you're putting something out. It doesn't imply that someone actually received that and used it. And this issue of transmission, I think, becomes a little bit more important later as we discuss how they've recruited agents and why those agents are important to them. So since 1927-28, the Chinese Communist Party has considered intelligence a specialized vocation. It's not always been professional, but it's always been a specialized vocation that only people with that kind of bent in their mind and that kind of interest could do this appropriately. Now, they may have been amateurs when they began, much like the people who went into intelligence in the United States with the Office of Strategic Services, but they became professional. In the 1930s, in the base area in Yan'an, they brought in NKVD advisors from the Soviet Union to help them develop operational tradecraft. They celebrate their history, and they publish histories, some quite remarkable ones in the last two decades, about these early days of Chinese intelligence to celebrate their heroes and their tradecraft, and to say that this is how we do intelligence, this is how we should learn for the younger generation that's coming up. Interestingly enough, the CCP and People's Republic of China intelligence system shares its origin with the modern US intelligence apparatus. That is, it was a surprise that led them to create this as a formal institution and a vocation that the party and then later the state needed to practice. For us, it was December 7th, 1941 at Pearl Harbor. For the Communist Party, it was April 12th, 1927, after the fall of Shanghai, when Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the Nationalist Party, the KMT, in conjunction with the large organized crime syndicate in Shanghai, the Green Gang, started what was called the White Terror, cracking down on the CCP cadre and trying to wipe them out and remove them from the cities as a political challenge to the Nationalist Party. They were a little bit slow to get off the ground, and it was late 27 and early 28 when they finally got around to creating a formal organization called the Special Department, the Tukhe in Chinese. And it was organized into four directorates. The first, which is the most well-known, is the Red Brigades, the dog-beating squad, the Dago Dui, as they were called. They were involved in sabotage and assassination, trying to run covert operations to break apart the KMT. The second directorate was communications or wireless. They were responsible for codes and intercept. The third was security for the party. They were responsible for manning the safe houses, setting up fake IDs, and generally providing the specialized security services to keep the CCP cadre in the cities underground and away from scrutiny. And the fourth directorate was intelligence. And there are a number of things that we could talk about from this early period, but the most important one has gone down in Chinese communist lore as the Longtan Sanjie, the three heroes of the dragon's lair. These three heroes, named Qian Zhuangfei, Hu Di, and Li Kunong, between late 1928 or early 1929 and 1931, basically saved the life of the party. What took place was that Qian, who had fled Beijing at the beginning of the White Terror, had come unknown into Nanjing, and searching for work, he had tested into a wireless communications training class. What he didn't realize at the time was this was actually the feeder organization for KMT intelligence. And he ran into his friend Li Kunong, who had been in Beijing with him and had been radicalized by the May 4th movement as well. And the two of them went back to the CCP leadership and said, "We have an opportunity here." And Qian Zhuangfei helped Hu Di and Li Kunong enter the KMT intelligence apparatus. Qian Zhuangfei himself shared a hometown with the head of KMT intelligence, Xu Anzeng, and because of his talent and because of those shared ties, he was quickly made the personal private secretary to the head of KMT intelligence, managing all of the paper flow for the KMT that was fed up in operations and everything else. Hu Di was sent to Tianjin and was in the KMT intelligence office there, and Li Kunong went to Shanghai. Now, they were steadily providing sort of operational intelligence into the CCP and helping them avoid the thrusts of KMT intelligence and police sweeps. But in 1931, in Wuhan, one of the directorate chiefs, the head of the Red Brigades, a man named Gu Xuanzhang, was captured. And he was never really much of an ideologue. He was more or less a thug. And he just liked the opportunity to inflict violence without much authority and with a lot of discretion. So the KMT was able to persuade him that he should defect and discuss what he knew as one of the senior most people in CCP intelligence. But he told his captors that you should not, under any circumstance, send a telegram to Nanjing and inform your superiors what has taken place. Let's just get on a ferry, let's go. But of course, his captors didn't listen. They wanted to count coup and sent the telegram anyway and said, this is who we've captured. The telegram arrived at the end of the business day as Xuanzang was walking out the door, and it landed on the desk of Qian Zhuangfei. So instead of calling his boss back, he sort of loses the telegram and hides it and sticks it under a lot of paper. Immediately contacts Li Kunong, who's the link back to the special department, and what begins is a general evacuation of the CCP underground apparatus in all of China's major cities, because Gu Xuanzhang knows all of the safe houses, he knows all of the techniques, he knows all of the people, and can identify the current pseudonyms that could be pointed to with the different pictures. What this created was basically an 18-hour head start for the CCP to get out. And a number of important figures, you know, an insignificant guy, as we know, Premier Zhou Enlai, was one of them. And Mao Zedong later said that without the Longtan Sanjie, the history of the CCP would have to be rewritten, and the history of the revolution would have to be reapproached if it didn't fail. Flashing forward to modern Chinese intelligence, you see two similar structures to sort of the US way of doing it, or most modern states. The military has its own apparatus in the Second Department and the Third Department. The Second Department is roughly equivalent to the Defense Intelligence Agency. And the Third Department is roughly equivalent to NSA or the Government Communications Headquarters in the United Kingdom. There's also the civilian side, the Ministry of State Security, with its national, provincial, and local level branches that looks very much like the old KGB. However, it never has quite had the political power that the KGB had. None of its ministers have ever sat on the Politburo. They've never been influential people, and they've almost always ended their career at the Ministry of State Security, unlike some of our Soviet, rather than the Yuri Andropov or Lavrenti Beria. What's interesting is that if you read Chinese sources, a number of the articles that have come out sort of describing this system say that 2PLA is China's CIA, not the civilian side, that it was known for its foreign intelligence operations. And in fact, most of the recent Chinese espionage cases that you might have read about, Chi Mak in San Diego, Guo Taishan, James Fondren, Greg Bergerson, were all related to military intelligence, not the civilian side. Now, the Ministry of State Security was created in 1983, and it took the foreign intelligence component that used to be in the party and put it together with the Ministry of Public Security, sort of like China's FBI, and took its counterintelligence and counterespionage functions and put them together. And in its evolution, it sort of steadily moved beyond this domestic focus and started thinking more about foreign intelligence. The current minister, a man named Geng Huichang, he ran an MSS think tank, was one of their American specialists in the 1980s, and he's the first of the four ministers that that state security has had that has actually had a foreign focus rather than a domestic focus. What's interesting is that this is taking place at the very same time that military intelligence has been reined back in from supporting the leadership about foreign intelligence to focus on military needs, the requirements of bomb damage assessment, the requirements to be able to find a U.S. aircraft carrier within 1,500 miles of the Chinese coast. And it's no longer been a terminal career function. Before, people might have risen to the top of 2PLA, and then their career ended. Now, we've seen the head of 2PLA become a deputy chief of staff in the Nanjing military region, which is China's most important military command that's focused primarily on Taiwan. The head of the third department has gone over to become a deputy commander of the 2nd Artillery, China's strategic rocket forces that you may have heard so much about with their missiles across the Taiwan Strait. Another director of 2PLA has become a deputy commander of the Air Force. And in the deputy chief of the general staff position that oversees all of the military intelligence, what used to be a position for defense attachés and people with contact with foreigners has become a position held by operational commanders, including some of the people who have had the most influence on shaping Chinese military doctrine, for example, General Zhang Qingsheng. So I think from this we can say that they do have professional organizations. They are something that matter, and this is something that has been a part of modern China in a way that our traditional views of Chinese intelligence have never really explained. But what would any discussion of intelligence be without some discussion of espionage cases? I mean, this is where we learn about people, their foibles, and where the rubber really meets the road in terms of how intelligence is run. And there are a few points to put on this. It's that there seems to be a domestic base for operations, with only two exceptions, and they're both relatively recent. Every Chinese espionage case that we know of begins on Chinese soil. And you know, whether you're talking about Larry Wu Taichin, who was arrested in 1985, he was recruited outside of Nanjing in 47 or 48. If you look at all of the Taiwanese espionage cases, it almost always involves a retired military official or a businessman who's in the mainland who gets recruited there. Then he comes back to Taiwan and finds his friends and sort of elicits new information out of them. To speak of a recent United States case, Glenn Duffy Shriver, who was arrested in the summer of 2010, was paid $70,000 by Chinese intelligence to apply to the State Department and the Central Intelligence Agency. But again, he was recruited in Shanghai while he was while he had moved back there to try to find work or to continue studying. The idea of having case officers overseas and recruiting sources and having this run the way we've become accustomed to thinking about intelligence operations is really only two cases that we can talk about. The first is a Uyghur named Baipur Maihusudi, who was arrested in Sweden in 2010. He was recruited by a diplomat and a journalist operating out of the Chinese embassy in Stockholm and reported on his fellow Uyghurs and the connections to the World Uyghur Congress and other potentially threatening forces, at least as Beijing sees them. The second is Taiwanese General Luo Xianzhe, who was arrested in early 2011, who was the head of the ROC Army's Electronic Information Directorate. He'd been recruited outside of Taiwan while he was a defense attaché in Thailand, again by an official operating out of an embassy. And then he was handled by a Chinese businesswoman who had authentic Australian citizenship. So they had taken the time to develop someone outside and get them real paperwork and then move to another country and handle this case. But this is really a relatively recent development from the 2000s. We know of very few other cases that have developed like that. It's almost always someone who gets recruited internally. And two of my friends have even received recruitment pitches by Chinese intelligence. Again, something that took place inside China. So what is the value of approaching intelligence this way? Well, first, it means that this person is fully vetted. You get to put 360 degrees of surveillance on them 24/7 while they're in the country. And if you go back to that idea of transmission, that it comes from the collection source to an intelligence officer to the bureaucracy and then to the leader, it actually makes sense to put a lot of emphasis on trusting a particular person. Because if you try to get documents, let's say out of the US National Security Council, you already have to have a lot of knowledge for those to make sense. They're not self-evidently important. It's not clear that they're a statement of policy, unless you know the US system very, very particularly. So if China has been closed off from much of the world for a long time, then why should we think that they have that kind of detailed knowledge of the documents and paper flows of these foreign governments? What seems to make sense is to find someone who can interpret what's taking place in Washington, D.C., or Taipei, or Tokyo, or anywhere else, and that person, that source, can be used to make the clear judgment about what's important related to the questions that are given to them. But there's a downside to this approach. The first is that you're entirely dependent on who goes to China. So if you think about the rise of this idea of the ethnic Chinese agent for Chinese intelligence, the question is who was going to China in the 1970s and 1980s when things first started opening up? They were ethnic Chinese who knew the language and could operate there. So it's not necessarily that they preferred ethnic Chinese, simply that was who was there and who they could recruit. And as we've moved along, we've seen them steadily improve as the quality of the person going to China has steadily improved. Glenn Duffy Shriver is only the first person that has actually been arrested and prosecuted for taking money from Chinese intelligence to apply to the US government. But he's not the first. The head of FBI counterintelligence in 1997 said, "We have seen people paid by Chinese intelligence to try to enter the Defense Department, CIA, the State Department, and other sort of investigative agencies inside the United States. We just didn't think it was serious enough that we needed to prosecute them and expose exactly what we knew, that we could just sort of shunt them aside and there would be no issue because these people were not necessarily capable of getting into the State Department and serving in a professional capacity." But now, as more and more talented people see their time as a college student or the early parts of their career going to China, it's become a more serious challenge in terms of dealing with the people who come back with the kinds of language skills and knowledge that companies and governments would like to have. But this also creates a blind spot, because who goes to China? People who are interested in Asia. If you wanted to know about US policy in the Middle East, China is not where these people go the beginning part of their careers, or where they go to study, or to take up a pre-doctoral or a post-doctoral fellowship. So it creates a certain amount of a blind spot, if you will, for Chinese intelligence and the information that they can collect. And this, more than anything, probably explains why, despite our best efforts to encourage the Chinese to stop with the computer network exploitation, the hacking that takes place, it probably provides something for Chinese intelligence that they cannot get elsewhere because of their domestic base of operations. It helps them fill in the blind spots. It helps them find the people and the targets and the information that they need as their interests expand in the Middle East, in Africa, in Latin America. And with that, I'll leave it there.
That's fascinating, Peter. It certainly raises a lot of questions, and we're going to grab some questions. The first question I would have is the note you sort of ended on. Are they now, though, going the Chinese embassies in Beirut or Cairo or wherever, are they now trying to recruit people, not Chinese, but trying to recruit locals there who can provide the kind of information that you say is their sort of blind spot?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer. One would think that the logic of their interests and what they would like to know would dictate that. But they've been incredibly reluctant to do this kind of clandestine recruitment out of the embassies. Something that you wouldn't think in a communist system, but the Ministry of Foreign Affairs actually made a case to Deng Xiaoping in 1985 that the Ministry of State Security and Military Intelligence should be restricted, if not removed, from Chinese embassies overseas, because their operations might derail China's rise and its effort to re-engage with the international community. In what communist system has the Ministry of Foreign Affairs ever won out over state security? So even though they were not entirely removed, I think it's clear that they had at least some sort of restriction placed on them, that they may be out there to attend public events, they may be out there to talk to people, but they've mostly targeted overseas Chinese, Tibetans, Uyghurs, Taiwanese, democracy activists, people that are not necessarily protected by the domestic security service. The FBI, for example, doesn't see its responsibility as protecting those communities from Chinese intelligence. But the reason why that case emerged in Sweden is because the government in Stockholm, and actually the Germans also recently, have made a decision that it's a responsibility of the state to protect these vulnerable populations from Chinese intelligence. So it's still tough to say exactly what is taking place out of a Chinese embassy or what is taking place by commercial operations overseas, but there does seem to be an emergence of more operations meeting in third countries, more operations being a little bit more focused from their overseas platforms.
Okay, this one is about cyber-based attacks in the United States. How sophisticated are Chinese hackers? And can you provide any insight on the frequency of such attempts in the United States?
Well, to tackle the latter question first, there's no way to gauge how frequent this takes place. There's simply too many ways to do it. There are too many ways to automate it. There are too many ways to count what takes place on a daily basis. As far as China's sophistication, it's a really mixed bag. One of the interesting points is that if you look at the structure of the Third Department or the structure of the Ministry of State Security, it's very decentralized. There's a national component, but there are also subnational elements that recruit locally or have different ways in which they recruit people into their organizations. So if you were to take Beijing, for example, or units that were based in Shanghai, they have access to China's best universities and the best talent. That may not be the case in Jiangxi province or in Anhui or any of a number of other places. So it's a very mixed bag in terms of the quality. Some of it is very professional and very thoughtful, patient, and well-developed. And others are a little bit hasty and a little bit loud and are discovered fairly easily. And to give you a sense of why it's not a good idea to take the grains of sand on faith that, they can simply pool this information and process it together, some of China's most sophisticated attempts, such as were discussed in the Mandiant report about Third Department hacking, were discovered as a different, less sophisticated attacker was identified. They got into the system, created a bunch of noise, and then as the IT experts were sort of cleaning the system and getting rid of it, they discovered what was actually something much more serious that was there and had no idea how long it was there and what it did. But that's at the high end, and there's plenty of things that take place on the low end.
Okay, we've got two related questions. The first one is, what do you see as the major focus of the Chinese intelligence effort? And this one is more specific. Which government does China see as the most threatening adversary and then as the most likely target for spying? Taiwan, Russia, or the United States?
So the way I would answer that question is to say that Chinese intelligence probably has, let's say, three priorities. The first is to prevent threats to state security. And what this means is simply threats that might relate to the subversion of the CCP and the Chinese state as it's currently constituted. And they had termed these groups the five poisons. The Tibetans, Uyghurs, Falun Gong, democracy activists, and the Taiwanese. The second is to contribute to China's rise, and there is a science and technology component to this. The third probably relates to unification with Taiwan. Now, if you read between the lines of what this says, you realize that where's the country that hosts a lot of democracy activists and is a place where the Falun Gong can operate safely, and who hosts the Falun Gong leader? If you look at one of the major sources of science and technology and the expertise that they would like, and where technology transfer cases seem to come up the most, and if you look at what's most important to Taiwan's continued autonomy and security, you see the United States. And you see the United States behind all three of these. And it means that we probably want to take a little more seriously the fears that are expressed in Chinese propaganda about the United States, or unnamed Western hostile forces, as they like to call us, that are threatening to subvert and divide and undermine China's rise and its political model.
Okay, this is going to zero in on Taiwan again. What's the current relationship between Beijing and Taiwan? And how would you compare the Taiwanese intelligence operation against China as compared to the Chinese operation against Taiwan?
Well, it's been said that cross-strait relations are the best that they've been in recent years because of the continued economic integration that has been the policy of the Ma Ying-jeou administration. But it raises a question of what's important in cross-strait relations. Is it simply that there is peace at any cost, or is it that the Republic of China survives and is an example to the mainland, that it is, if you want to call it flippantly, the China that works? It depends on what your priorities are for what Taiwan is or the Republic of China stands for. At one level, the security situation is probably as good as it's been, and certainly better than it's been since 1949. But one of the points that's been noted is that the pace of Chinese military modernization, the buildup of Chinese forces across from Taiwan, the planning for a Taiwan contingency by the People's Liberation Army, and the efforts of Chinese espionage against Taiwan have not slowed in any way since the warming of cross-strait relations began. With respect to the quality of Taiwanese intelligence on the mainland, it's one of those things where it's unclear at any given moment how good it is. But what is striking is that if you look at how China has publicized its espionage cases, and it never publicizes the ones that the British or the Americans or the Russians conduct inside China, but they do publicize Taiwan's captured spies. The Taiwanese supposedly recruited the entire leadership of the PLA Air Force Command College. Seven major generals or senior colonels with responsibility for this institution and access to the PLA's military planning. In 2003, 2004, something like 90 Taiwanese spies were arrested as part of an observation network in southern China to be able to observe whether missiles moved out of their barracks and went to deployed sites. And I asked a senior Taiwanese defense official at a meeting in DC a few months ago about this question of, you know, we've read about all of these espionage cases that the mainland has captured. How good would you say you are now? How confident are you that you would have the kind of political military warning that you would need to defend Taiwan if the balloon went up? And he said, I think we're fairly confident that we would understand what's taking place in China and that we would have the warning that we needed to mobilize. So they seem to be doing all right, at least.
Okay, now we're going to move back to a sort of history question, which was not covered in your earlier remarks. After the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s in China, what effect did that have on the intelligence operation there? Was it totally revamped as a result?
I'm not sure that totally revamped would be the right way to describe it. Perhaps totally destroyed, at least on the civilian side. As those of you who are familiar with the history of the Cultural Revolution know, the PLA was basically the one state, party-state institution that continued functioning without the same buffets that the rest of society and the government faced. And a lot of the civilian intelligence cases, the active cases, were actually handed over to the military to manage, because this became a major purge of the civilian intelligence services housed within the party, because they had had contact with foreigners and they had had engagement in places or given information, sort of chicken feed, if you will, to foreigners. But counter-espionage at that time became an ideological problem, something that you used to corral someone or bring them into the fold. It wasn't necessarily something based on a concrete action. And ahead of the creation of the Ministry of State Security in 1983, there was actually a little propaganda campaign that was dictated, if you will, by Deng Xiaoping's statement that we should seek truth from facts, shi shi qiu shi. And the point was that counter-espionage should no longer be a party matter. It shouldn't be an ideological matter. It should be something that the state handles based on concrete actions. And they said the only people that ever violated this were Kong Sheng and the Gang of Four. And this was actually, there was such a revulsion for what happened to Chinese intelligence at that time that Kong Sheng was termed in a speech by then Party General Secretary Hu Yaobang as China's Beria, who had been Stalin's partner in the terror of the 1930s. And they supposedly exhumed his remains from Babashan Cemetery, where all of the party leadership is buried, and moved it to we know not where.
Okay, this is another broad question. What's the relationship between Chinese intelligence and their operations to China's movement globally with regard to its soft power?
Broad enough. Boy, small question with small implications, I think. One of the points that would be worth noting is that interest in a global presence and soft power is something that is a sort of a whole of government operation. It's not something that's given to simply one agency or one part of the party to function. It's sort of an overriding policy direction, a fengzhen, if you will, that explains where how people should govern their actions and how they should think about what they're doing. And there have been a lot of different elements of this, but one of the parts of Chinese intelligence that interacts most notably with the rest of the world are the think tanks that are associated with it, such as the China Institutes of Contemporary International Relations, where the current minister came out of, Geng Huichang. And these groups interact with foreign embassies, foreign experts, and they present sort of charming variations of the official line. But it often gets fed back into foreign government systems as real information, or as information that is something to be considered as distinct from the official line. So there's at least at some level an intelligence part for managing perceptions in that way. I was also asked to evaluate a fundraising proposal that had come from a major US think tank that could be read at best charitably as an MSS covert influence program that they were going to pay 20% for, and the US side would raise 80% of the money, roughly $1.2 million. So there is some covert level of this. But in a broader sense, the party itself doesn't necessarily rely on bureaucracy to handle this. There have been a lot of questions about the Confucius Institutes and whether or not they house intelligence officers, but there's no evidence to say that intelligence has been allowed anywhere near the Confucius Institutes, that this has been handled as a party matter within the United Front Work Department and other state institutions as a part of a way to present a face. So intelligence does not, and state security does not have that same role that we saw during the Warsaw Pact years in East Germany, in Poland, Czechoslovakia, and the Soviet Union. It's intelligence is sort of something that's specialized and kept away from a lot of these whole government endeavors because it might discredit the whole enterprise. And it's much harder to identify some of these other components and what they may mean. In part because we've forgotten a lot of the Chinese Revolution and how the party actually functioned.
Okay, this is something of a related question. It's much more specific, and you may have sort of partially answered it. China's extensive focus on lining up natural resources in Africa and elsewhere, to what extent is China's intelligence network cooperating and working with business interests in what they're doing in Africa?
There's no way you can read the newspapers or do deep internet searches to find answers to that question, unfortunately. The reality is that a lot of what takes place in the party and the connections between the party and business and the military and business and the party are incredibly opaque and often not necessarily well controlled. So, you know, a friend of mine pointed out who's done IT security work that he's actually sat over the shoulder of someone from the third department doing freelance work to hack into a competitor state-owned enterprise of a local party official who has business interests inside China. And that's hard to explain what that might actually mean or how to interpret what's going on abroad. If it's opaque inside China, then our ability to unravel that, you know, based on a close reading of the open source, it's incredibly difficult to say what might actually be taking place. But suffice to say, there are enough connections and there are enough family ties and other ways in which people build relationships that you would have to suspect that somehow, in some way, that people instrumentalize these government relationships and try to figure out some way to leverage those state institutions.
Okay, Peter, we're going to give you a breather. This is not an intelligence, Chinese intelligence question, but with your familiarity with China and the one-child rule that ended up meaning that China was going to have 55% men and 45% women, the question is, what are Chinese men going to do in the future to find wives?
Well, I think for a lot of them, they're not. There's a rather famous interview on a TV program where a young woman said, I would rather cry in the back of a BMW than be happy on the back of a bicycle. So one of the most fascinating places for social research that you can look into, really, is sort of the revival of the matchmaker, in essence, and dating services and how young men and young women find each other, or indeed whether or not young men actually have much of a shot with many of the young women who may have better alternatives from men who are a little more established in their careers and have a little bit more to offer. It's an interesting topic, but I'm afraid quite a few young men are going to be left out in the dark.
It's going to be a frustrating century for a lot of Chinese kids. All right, does Chinese intelligence use Chinese students in the United States? And presumably the answer is yes. If so, how effectively, and how effective are we in seeing, in stopping it or preventing it or turning them?
I think the bigger question here is the Chinese government's use of Chinese students. Again, China's a big place with a lot of different government agencies and a lot of different ways in which it leverages its overseas population. It's not necessarily something that belongs with the intelligence services. I mean, certainly people going abroad, again, if you think about an internal focus, the idea that you can vet someone internally and send them abroad and have them be valuable means that, of course, some students may have been recruited. Now, one of the best things that the United States has going for it is that despite what you read about foreign students getting PhDs or other graduate work here and going back, the majority of them, the vast majority of them, continue to remain inside the United States. You know, Chinese immigrants come to the U.S. for the same reason that many other people do. They want a better life and they want a different set of opportunities. And this is why I think that it's actually so pernicious, this idea that Chinese intelligence focuses on ethnic Chinese, because it means that we're dismissing the interests and where the heart is of a lot of people that come here. As far as how effectively Chinese students get used, in terms of collecting intelligence, probably not that effectively, because what do students have access to? You know, maybe they're good for science and technology acquisition because, let's say at MIT, if you were doing a PhD in engineering, you might work on something like a ventilation system for a submarine. It's not classified, but you can't just go look it up and figure out how this works. And given that at least one Chinese submarine has had all of its people killed on it because the ventilation system failed about 10 years ago, certainly something like that would be of interest. If you're talking about putting people out in the street, say for counter protests when the Dalai Lama visits or against the Falun Gong for example, when the Olympic torch went through, then they do seem to be, the Chinese government at least, seems to be relatively effective at rallying people and getting them bused to locations and mobilizing their students to provide some sort of support. But as far as intelligence goes, hard to say, but I don't think it's as effective as people would like to make it out to be.
Okay, here's one of our guests has a sort of personal question aimed at you. What university in China did you spend time at? What was your purpose in doing so? What was the outcome? And finally, why are you at Cambridge now?
I studied at Tsinghua University in Beijing, and I was there for a little bit over a year. Primary part of it was to learn Chinese and to get my Chinese that I had started at University of Washington a lot better. I quickly found that I didn't fit in so well to the way the Chinese as a second language program worked. And so I found private tutors, and I showed up and took the exams, paid my tuition for the next semester, and never showed up to class, instead auditing lectures from some of the people there, including a professor from the National Defense University in China, who was at Tsinghua on a sabbatical and was giving lectures on Chinese strategy. A guy named Yan Chuitong taught an international relations course that I attended. And I also attended lectures on Chinese law and sort of the development of Chinese culture. So it was overall a fairly good learning experience. My Chinese got a lot better, and it was a lot better then than it is now. I came back after meeting a number of people there, much more focused on my studies and a better sense of how I could make use of my time at university. As for why Cambridge, easy question. It's a fairly easy question, because if you look at the universities worldwide where you can do a respectable PhD, there are really only about four or five universities with more than one person that are interested in intelligence. That's University of Aberystwyth, King's College London, Brunel, also in outside of London in Uxbridge, a place that I can't remember in Romania, and Cambridge. And I gave a similar talk to this in Cambridge in November 2012, and on the strength of that, they said that you should think about coming here. And so I am.
That's great. All right, this is the final question. It's back to intelligence. The U.S. has intelligence partners throughout the world that we cooperate and exchange information with. Who are China's partners, and what type of collaborations are in play now?
that's one of those questions that is nearly impossible to answer. We can look at the travel of Chinese ministers and perhaps make a little bit of a judgment about what takes place, but it's not clear that there's widespread ties in that regard, that they don't have the same kind of well-developed intelligence liaison ties that other countries have. You might want to say that, well, they could have these kinds of relationship with the North Koreans. But what's interesting is that a number of people that I met at a meeting in January 2006 that were North Korean experts in China ended up being arrested a couple of years later for espionage because they were spying for the North Koreans. That's not the kind of thing that endears you to a partner. As a former CIA person once told me, there are intelligence services that we are friendly with, but there are no friendly intelligence services. As far as one of the places where it seems like there are a growing set of relationships, the Minister of Public Security, and who's now the head of the Political Legal Commission, Meng Jianzhu, was important in setting up a series of ties with Southeast Asian countries, particularly along the Mekong, basically for shared patrols and sharing of information, because in October of 2011, 13 Chinese sailors were killed on the Mekong by a drug lord. The Ministry of Public Security also helped authorities in Laos and Thailand, and to a lesser extent Burma, try to track the perpetrators and eventually did catch them. And if you read James Mann's About Face, there was a relationship the United States built up in the late 1970s and early 1980s to replace the monitoring posts that we lost in Iran to rebuild them in Xinjiang to watch Soviet rocket tests. So at least at one point, the United States was one of the important partners.
Okay, we've got time for one more question. And I'm going to ask it. And Peter, that is with your experience in China and the time you've spent worrying about China, you're reading these days that there's a possibility that there's going to be a real conflict between the United States and China. And then there are other people that guess that need not happen, that we can, resolve things. The 21st century is going to be the century of China, and we'll accept this and work through it. What do you think? What's the likelihood of actual military conflict between the United States and China over the next decade or two?
Well, I think one of the easiest way to describe what's taking place is that as China's power is creating a sphere of what it calls active defense further and further away from Chinese borders, and the United States and its view of primacy and what our military should be able to do has also moved further and further from its borders, that we have sort of overlapping spheres of active defense, if you will. And that increases the risk. But risk is not a choice, and risk is not necessarily something, or it's a probability, it's not a certainty. And I think the important point is that we perhaps should re-examine our assumptions of the U.S.-China relationship, what it means, what our priorities are, what are we willing to concede or compromise on, what are the places where we won't concede. China makes a big deal about protecting its core interests, one of which is its political system. What are the implications of that? But at the same time, in all of China's discussions about the U.S. should respect Chinese core interests, they never seem to take some of ours into account. And I think the easiest one to describe would be the freedom of navigation. At one point in the Jefferson administration, we were spending roughly 20 to 30% of our GDP on freedom of navigation to support Marines and Navy on the Barbary Coast. If 200 years of willingness to use force to protect freedom of navigation, and indeed we went to war with Britain about 12 years later, from our first Barbary expedition to protect this, how is that not a U.S. core interest? I mean, it seems fairly clear that if we've been willing to do this for 200 years, 150 years longer than China has been a state in the modern sense, then this is something that we need to, we should ask Beijing to consider and think through. And if we're unwilling to make these core questions forward about our implications, our interests, what we can compromise on, what we can't compromise on, then I think the risk of these overlapping spheres of active defense will become more and more dangerous as time goes on.
Thank you very much. It's been a great session.